You're listening to The Philosopher's Note on the Myths of Happiness. More wisdom in less time.
Hi, this is Brian. Welcome to The Philosopher's Note on the Myths of Happiness. What should make you happy but doesn't, what shouldn't make you happy but does, by Sonia Lubomirsky. As always, let's kick it off with a quote. Nearly all of us buy into what I call the myths of happiness, beliefs that certain adult achievements, marriage, kids, jobs, wealth, will make us forever happy, and that certain adult failures or adversities, health problems, not having a life partner, having little money, will make us forever unhappy. This reductive understanding of happiness is culturally reinforced and continues to endure, despite overwhelming evidence that our well-being does not operate according to such black-and-white principles. What I hope this book will make singularly clear is that although it may appear that some of these major challenges will definitively and permanently change our lives for better or for worse, it is really our responses to them that govern their repercussions. The message of the myths of happiness is that, ultimately, we each can identify the steps to take to forge our way to a fulfilling life and help ourselves reach and exceed our happiness potentials. End quote. That is Sonia Lubomirsky from The Myths of Happiness. This is the second note on Sonia's work we've created. Her first book remains one of my all-time favorites, The How of Happiness. This one is another great book. Sonia is one of the world's leading positive psychology researchers. Her award-winning and very well-funded research is on, quote, the possibility of permanently increasing happiness. How cool is that? This book focuses on, you guessed it, the myths of happiness. Those things we think will make us happy or devastated, but don't. And, of course, Sonia walks us through what does lead to sustainable happiness and flourishing. The book combines the best empirical wisdom from positive psychology, social psychology, personality psychology, and clinical psychology, with over 700 scholarly references. I always love connecting ancient wisdom and fun self-help with solid research, so this book was a great treat. Of course, it's packed with big ideas. I'm excited to share some of my favorites, so let's jump straight in. First big idea, hedonic adaptation plus your psychological immune system. Quote, one of my primary scientific interests is in the area of hedonic adaptation, namely, the fact that human beings have the remarkable capacity to grow habituated or inured to most life changes. A hot topic today in the fields of psychology and economics, hedonic adaptation explains why both the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat abate with time. What is particularly fascinating about this phenomenon, however, is that it is most pronounced with positive experiences. Indeed, it turns out that we are prone to take for granted pretty much everything positive that happens to us. When we move into a beautiful new loft with a grand view, when we partake of plastic surgery, when we purchase a fancy new automobile or nth generation smartphone, when we earn the corner office and a raise at work, when we become immersed in a new hobby, and even when we wed, we obtain an immediate boost of happiness from the improved situation. But the thrill only lasts for a short time. Over the coming days, weeks, and months, we find our expectations ramping upward, and we begin taking our new improved circumstances for granted. We are left with felicific stagnation. End quote. Hedonic adaptation. I'm sure you're familiar with it at this point. Quick recap of the basic idea. We get used to all the good stuff in our lives really quickly. Therefore, thinking that, quote, when we fill in the blank, get rich, get married, have kids, etc., we will finally be happy, is a really bad plan if sustainable happiness is your target. Dan Gilbert is another leading researcher in this area. He tells us we're really bad at effective forecasting, or predicting how we'll feel about something, good or bad, in the future. His fortune cookie maxim sums it up. Nothing in life is as important as you think it is while you are thinking about it. As Sonia says, in other words, we exaggerate the effect a life change will have upon our happiness because we cannot foresee that we won't always be thinking about it. So, we adapt quickly. Got it. What can we do about it? Well, the first section of the book is all about connections. The second is about work and money, while the third is on looking back. The first chapter is about your marriage. Short story here is the fact that pretty much all relationships go through the inevitable decline from uber passionate awesome to, shall we say, a more moderate level of awesome. The myth of happiness is the idea that you should be able to burn at a 10-level passion forever. And if you're not, something's wrong with you and/or your relationship. The wisest among us have what Sonia calls a prepared mind, and we know that this hedonic adaptation is inevitable. The trick is to navigate the transition from what researchers call passionate love to companionate love with grace and happiness. Sonia offers a bunch of ways to go about doing that. Here are a few of my favorites. Number one, appreciation. This is her number one tip and a favorite at the Johnson household. As we know and discuss all the time, there's a ton of research showing how this boosts happiness. The trick is to make it a regular practice. Basic idea is super simple. If you want to stop taking things or your spouse or your kids, etc., for granted, appreciate them. Alexandra recently brought appreciations back to our family. It's awesome. Each night, usually over dinner or during our evening walk, we take turns appreciating one another. What's amazing is how quickly Emerson joined the party. Although only four, he comes up with some awesome appreciations. I was smiling as I typed that and smiling as I read it now. Second tip, the Michelangelo phenomenon. You know how Michelangelo reportedly said, "I saw an angel in the block of marble and I just chiseled till I set him free"? Well, we need to see the best in our significant others and kids and friends and colleagues and everyone else in our lives and help our partners realize their ideal selves. And then the third tip is what's called active constructive. Another related practice here is to really celebrate our partner's successes and dreams. When our partners share something they're excited about, it's important to respond in an active, constructive way. That is, with interest and delight. Don't point out all the things that could go wrong, which is active destructive. Celebrate and high-five them with that interest and delight. A few other tips, add some variety and surprises to your relationships, and touch. Lots of basic, simple, non-sexual touch. A new game I'm playing is to touch Alexander each time we're close in the kitchen. Hashtag little things. Another little PS here. So we hedonically adapt to the positive stuff, such that we take for granted what was once super awesome. We also adapt to the negative stuff via what researchers call psychological immunity. In short, we're way stronger than we give ourselves credit for. Next big idea, the most robust strategy to boost optimism is, quote, "Whether our optimism is big or little, many of us waver in our expectations of the future. Fortunately, numerous research-tested activities have been shown to boost positive thinking. The most robust strategy involves keeping a journal regularly for 10 to 20 minutes per day, in which we write down our hopes and dreams for the future. E.g., in 10 years I will be married and a homeowner, then we visualize them coming true, and describe how we might get there and what that would feel like. This exercise, even when engaged in as briefly as 2 minutes, makes people happier and even healthier." End quote. Now, whenever I read a line like, "the most robust strategy," I sit up even taller than normal and start asterisking and underlining and folding pages over so we can make sure we soak in the goodness. Lines like that are a lover of wisdom's dream and what I'm hunting for when I'm reading books and mining big ideas for us. So let's take note. The most, not even one of the, but the most robust strategy to boost your optimism is to take some time each day to write down your goals and get excited about your hopes and dreams for the future. Little side note here, a ton of self-help teachers say the same thing. In fact, just this week I read Brian Tracy's Goals, which emphasized this practice as well. But I got to admit, although I get inspired to do it and experiment with it when I read a self-help author recommend a powerful tip, I get really fired up / all-in committed when that idea is backed up by robust empirical data and a non-pom-pom waving conservative scientist starts dropping the most robust strategy lines on me. back to the regular scheduled programming. My current practice takes about 5 minutes. Super simple. I start drawing a little O in the upper right corner representing Optimize. Then I write down Optimize plus Optimize Enterprises Public Benefit Corporation, which of course is our business, makes me smile every time I write it down. Then Optimize.me, our shiny new URL. Then I write down our purpose, our mission, and our strategy. And then I draw a series of mountain peaks representing my and our 3 plus 5 plus 10 plus 25 plus 50 year goals. Actually, first I draw a little Maslow triangle thing and emphasize the base of the pyramid, celebrating the fact that we've created a really solid, profitable foundation. By the way, haven't shared the exciting news yet. We hit the $1 million plus revenue rate. Yay. Thanks for your support. And that will fuel our growth in the years plus decades ahead. So I start by celebrating that. And as I draw those mountain peaks and write out those goals, I smile and feel and visualize achieving them. Then I remind myself of my top three priorities, energy plus family plus service. Then, most importantly, I flip the page over and write down Masterpiece Day at the top, followed by my number one goal, plus my number two, plus my number three for the day, along with that week's goal. Then, I get to work. We'll talk more about what science says are the right kind of goals to set in a moment. For now, are you all in on taking at least a couple minutes to journal your goals, plus hopes, plus dreams? Let's do this. Next big idea, navigating the ultradian dip. Quote, most of us have heard of circadian rhythms, daily cycles that regulate when we feel sleepy, close to bedtime and throughout the night, and when we feel alert and wake, upon waking and throughout the day. The word circadian means about a day, so a circadian rhythm occurs once in a 24-hour period. The circadian rhythm is essentially our internal biological clock, which is sensitive to light and dark. Few of us, however, have heard of another type of bodily cycle called the ultradian rhythm. We cycle through ultradian stages every 90 minutes or so, but no longer than 120 minutes during sleep. What's more, we continue to experience these 90 to 120-minute cycles while we are awake as well. Practically, this means that for about an hour and a half to 2 hours after rising in the morning, we feel particularly vigorous and focused, able to sustain concentration and energy throughout our activities. At the end of that interval, however, we experience a 20-minute period of fatigue, lethargy, and difficulty concentrating. This is the ultradian dip. End quote. We've talked about ultradian rhythms a few times in these notes. See Manage Your Day-to-Day plus Toughness Training for Life for more. My friend Pilar Gerasimo is all about this as well. Check out our interview plus her podcast episode where she talks about it more. Know this, as Sonia says, our energy oscillates. We're focused and on, then we need to relax and turn off for 15 to 20 minutes. Getting attuned to this natural rhythm is a really smart idea. I've been working on this and deliberately plus 1% optimizing my masterpiece days to bake it in. Super fun to work everything around these rhythms so I can go really deep in my focused work time, then step back and recharge with a hike or workout or time with the family, etc. How are you doing with this? You notice how your energy starts to dip after 60 to 90 to 120 minutes? Pay attention. Step back, recharge, repeat. Next big idea, got the affluenza virus? Quote, why are materialistic tendencies important to identify? A mountain of research has shown that materialism depletes happiness, threatens satisfaction with our relationships, harms the environment, renders us less friendly, likable, and empathetic, and makes us less likely to help others and contribute to our communities. Not everyone who is prosperous is focused on fame, power, and riches. Not everyone catches the so-called affluenza virus. But it's a risk that threatens our happiness as we are surrounded by conveniences and luxuries. As philosophers, religious figures, and humanistic psychologists have long contended, the pursuit of money and reputation redirects our energies and passions away from deeper and more meaningful social connections and growth experiences and prevent us from achieving our full potentials. As we spend more of our time making money, the opportunity costs of reading poetry, playing catch with our child, or taking a walk with a friend become so high that it becomes irrational to do such things. All the more reason to learn what research has to say about how to avoid the excesses of consumption and materialism and spend money in ways that make us happy. End quote. That's from part two on work and money, in which Sonia walks us through the science of how money affects our well-being. Short story, it's complicated. First, money definitely helps increase happiness when we're talking about meeting basic needs. Then, quote, although having more money boosts our satisfaction with life, it has little, if any, impact on the daily positive and negative emotions and the uplifts and hassles we experience, end quote. In other words, if you ask people how they're feeling in general about life, more money leads to higher reported levels of happiness, in general. But if you get specific with how they feel today, or at 9 a.m. or 2 p.m. or 6 p.m. yesterday, money isn't going to predict much. Sonia gives us four principles that psychological science suggests we live by if we want to optimally enjoy our money. Here's a super quick look. First, don't spend money on stuff. You'll hedonically adapt to that. Rather, spend money on experiences and, quote, on developing ourselves as people, on growing, and on investing in interpersonal connections. Number two, spend money on others, not yourself. Fascinating research here. If you give people $20 and have them spend it on themselves, they'll be less happy than if they spend it on others. Number three, spend money to give you time. Time affluence is a much better predictor of happiness than pure affluence. So use your money to buy time for yourself to do meaningful stuff. And number four, spend money now, but wait to enjoy it. There's a ton of happiness in the anticipation of something. So, for example, book a trip for 6 months from now, then look forward to it the whole time. And book more mini trips rather than one huge one. More on that in the next idea. Little PS here. Check out our notes on happiness by another couple leading positive psychologists. They give us some more cool insights on money and what they call psychological wealth. Next big idea, science of happiness. Frequency is greater than intensity. Quote, are such positive experiences too run-of-the-mill to truly impact our happiness and help us cope with real hardships? Given what we know about the benefits of positive emotions, should we strive to experience big, intense highs rather than aiming for frequent, ordinary bursts of pleasure? In Chapter 6, I recommended that we spend our money on many small pleasures rather than a few big ones. This is because the results of research favor the ordinary over the intense. It turns out that the key to happiness and health, and all of their auspicious byproducts, is not how intensely happy we feel, but how often we feel positive or happy. For example, in a study that followed people aged 18 to 94 over the course of 13 years, those with more frequent positive moments, but not more intense positive moments, lived longer. Indeed, seemingly trivial behaviors can offer regular mood boosts that accumulate over time. End quote. All right, quick quiz. Which would you prefer? A jumbo intense feeling of uber happiness or a bunch of frequent little micro moments of happiness? As you might have guessed from the above passage, the myth of happiness is that the intense highs are what lead to happiness. But the science says that it's those little moments that provide the most sustainable, true happiness. Frequency is greater than intensity. So look for and enjoy those little moments. For me today, that included a sunrise hike, always awe-inspiring, time with Emerson and the family, and reading a story to Emerson before his nap after enjoying lunch together. I always appreciate the fact that I could even do that, and a ton of other little things. How about you? Let's repeat. Quote, it turns out that the key to happiness and health and all of their auspicious byproducts is not how intensely happy we feel, but how often we feel positive or happy. Remember, frequency is greater than intensity. Next big idea, goal pursuit versus attainment. One is much wiser. Quote, one of the surest ways to focus on the future without dwelling on a seemingly idyllic past is by working towards significant life goals. There is no happiness without action. there is no happiness without goal pursuit. However, as I mentioned earlier, it is important to choose our goals wisely and to develop the ability to redirect our goals in ways that can bring us even greater happiness. The goals we select, if you recall, must be intrinsically rather than extrinsically motivated, prompted by our own sense of meaning and enjoyment as opposed to that of our parents or culture. They must be harmonious rather than conflicting with one another. They must satisfy innate human needs, such as the need to be an expert at something, to connect with others, and to contribute to our communities, rather than simply desiring to be rich, powerful, beautiful, or famous. They must be aligned with our own authentic values. They must be reachable and flexible, and ideally they should focus on attaining something rather than evading or running away from something. The pursuit of all of these types of goals has been found to be associated with greater happiness, fulfillment, and perseverance. Furthermore, although we can and should reach for our loftiest dreams, we need only to begin by breaking the goals down into sub-goals and daily aims. End quote. That is a magical list of the key ingredients to scientifically sound goal setting. You might want to rewind and re-listen. First, get rid of your goals to be rich, hot, and famous. As discussed in Why We Do What We Do, manically chasing those extrinsic goals is a great way to make yourself psychologically unstable. Much wiser to focus on the intrinsic goals of becoming a better human, connecting with others, and making a contribution to your community. And as you do that, make sure you focus on the pursuit of those goals, not the attainment. Sonia talks about her quibbles with traditional self-help goal recommendations. In addition to being based on opinion plus anecdote rather than on scientific research, she says, quote, "The entire follow your dreams world places a heavy emphasis on goals achievement rather than goal pursuit. In other words, the authors assume that what readers want above all is to reach a particular goal and that the attainment of that pinnacle is primary," end quote. In other words, most goal-setting gurus lead us into the happiness myth of thinking we'll be happy when we get, fill in the blank. But we now know that we're going to hedonically adapt to that. So let's focus on the pursuit of the goals rather than an obsessive focus on the attainment and enjoy a ton more happiness as we optimize and actualize. That is a very quick look at this great book, The Myths of Happiness. Let's enjoy some great quotes and then we'll officially wrap it up. Charlotte Bronte tells us, "Life is so constructed that the event does not, cannot, will not match the expectation." Socrates tells us, "He who is not contented with what he has would not be contented with what he would like to have." Sonia tells us, "Learning to be more positive and optimistic means learning to see opportunities and difficulties, to construe the world as full of possibilities and wonder." Louis Pasteur tells us, "Chance favors the prepared mind." Sonia tells us, "Distracting ourselves from toxic comparisons, concentrating on our own internal standards, and focusing on the journey in pursuit of our dreams rather than on the end result will redirect our attention and energies from the I'll be happy when mentality and toward more fruitful horizons." Sonia tells us, "The ideal goals are ones that nourish our basic drives to grow, feel competent and self-sufficient, connect with others, and contribute to our communities." William James says, "My experience is what I agree to attend to." We can talk about that quote for an entire class. "My experience is what I agree to attend to." We make choices about what we will attend to. That creates our reality. And finally, Sonia tells us, "There are many ways to find meaning and purpose. One is to establish a metric by which our life will be judged and, from today, to resolve to live each day in such a way that our life will be graded a success." That is an awesome quote. "There are many ways to find meaning and purpose. One is to establish a metric by which our life will be judged and from today to resolve to live each day in such a way that our life will be graded a success." What's your metric? How are you going to measure yourself and your life? Get clear on that. Resolve to live each day in such a way that your life will be graded a success based on that metric. It's a great way to bust the myths of happiness and create true, sustainable happiness and a deep sense of flourishing. I wish you that. Hope you have another awesome day. See ya.
We hope you enjoyed this Philosopher's Note. Please go to brianjohnson.me to download more.